folks, and welcome to episode 51 of the Mini PC Show. Big talk, little computers. How you doing, Dork?
Better now. I understand why browsers are the way they are. We have a lot of demands we put on them. So when they act up and they're flaky, I don't want to say I don't blame them, and I'm not going to say I'm not surprised, but sometimes it just boggles me what the hell happens with these things, where it just goes off on its own.
Yeah, and I just rebooted, so I'm a little surprised, because I am a browser tab hoarder, and I'll have N number of browsers open with N number of tabs, and I try to segregate my tabs on topic, and because I'm interested in 100 different things, that usually means I got a lot of topics open.
Yeah, that ain't bad. I just think of it as on-demand organization. Yeah, no time to stop and organize. Just keep moving forwards. A really quick PSA, I will say, and I'm going to make the opposite PSA on that show. We just launched the Makers Podcast, which is a 3D Maker podcast, starting out at the very basic about 3D printing, CNCing, and making. I will say that show and this show will have a lot of cross-contamination, if you will. They're both playing in the same pool. They both are going to have a lot of topics that relate to each other. So once in a while, we're going to get into a topic here where I'll say, if you want more details about that, go to the Maker Podcast episode, blah, 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 whatever. Because I don't want to talk about the same things too much on both shows. And on that show, when we start to get in deep into Octopi, we're just going to gloss over some of its basic features and say, if you want to know more about Octopi, the Mini PC Show is the place to go to learn all about it and mini computing operating systems. But we're going to go through like how to take advantage of it with 3D printing. Rich is also on that show, so he's pulling double duty.
So not only is it topics, but it's hosts.
And host, and except on that show, we have, I want to say, 7 people
yeah,
on the show.
I just listened to the show this morning, and I thought we did quite good for the number of people that we had.
Well, I'll say this is where I think experience pays off. Doing Linux Basics for a couple years, where sometimes we literally had 15 or more people on a single show. Mumble, I think, is the good application to use when you have more than 5 or 6 people on a single show. It just makes it a little bit cleaner, a little bit more patient, a little bit of a slower pace, less likelihood of background noise ruining everyone's audio, and a little bit less likely to have people speaking over each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right about that.
But that is a different show. We are talking about mini PCs, and I will say first, real quick, update Pinebook. The update is, I know a guy who literally, I want to say on April, I can't remember the exact date, was when they started to announce you can order it and emails were going out. I know a guy literally like the day after that, I want to say it was like April the 3rd or 7th, literally the very next day got an email. He ordered it immediately. He literally had his Pinebook in less than 7 days.
Crap.
Okay. Now, I know people who ordered theirs week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks before me. We're all still waiting on our Pinebooks. I don't think anything nefarious is going on. I just think they were not ready for it. They were not properly organized. They were not properly set up. Now, the disappointment I have is if this is, in fact, and it does seem like this is, in fact, the exact same company as Pine64, who already went through a successful Kickstarter, they should be aware of this and at least some of the hurdles that had to overcome. So I don't think their problem really is they're just overwhelmed. I'm afraid that the problem is they can't make the hardware fast enough.
Well,
and that scares me.
So I'll start by saying I ordered. My order number is 18818. I don't know if that means anything. And I ordered on May 3rd a 14-inch Pinebook. And, you know, I don't know how to track it or anything, which part of the fun of ordering.
There's none.
Yeah. Dor and I have talked about this. Part of the fun of ordering something is looking at the tracking. And it's like, ooh, you know, it's in California. Ooh, it's in New York. Ooh, it's on its way to my local post office. So I'm a little bummed about that because that is kind of part of the experience. The other thing I'm surprised at is because if they're handing out slots, basically built slots, you know, built to order slots as they are, that they aren't in tight control over the volume, unless they got a little too optimistic.
Hopefully, it's literally something like this. The manufacturer had an emergency order from Nintendo to make more Switches, or from Apple to make more iPhones, or Samsung to make more Galaxy S8s, and they basically got outbid. So the number that they expected isn't every day can't be matched.
Right, right.
What I also really hope is that that does not mean we will have a possibility of less quality control going on. And I'm a little bit afraid because in 2 weeks, I want to say 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, I'm going to Disney. The wife, the kids, going to Disney, where I'm going to do everything in my power to be in the shade as much as possible and stay out of the frigging sun as much as possible. Wish me luck. I'm literally having my friend, a coworker who just moved in less than a mile from my house every day. I'm going to ask him at around five something, can you please drive by my house? And if you see a box, you know, take it with you, put it in the house or whatever, because there's no tracking information. Nobody that I know has gotten any tracking information, and everybody I know who's tried to contact them asking for any information gets an email back basically just saying, we're doing our best, we'll let you know when we have an update.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I mean, I was kind of surprised. I did expect at the end of May to get my upboard squared, or up to, however you want to say it. And I was very excited to have gotten it last week. And there was no tracking information. I don't remember last time if they did send me tracking information when I ordered the first upboard.
I don't recall.
Yeah, I thought I did. But I was just excited to, I got a UPS label on the door, and I'm like, this must be it. And then I looked up the number, and it came from the Netherlands. And I'm like, oh, it must be the upboard. So right. I was pretty excited.
Right. Well, then to go from my disappointment to your, at least, actual hardware in hand. So you haven't really had a lot of time to play with it. Maybe a total of a couple hours, it seems like.
So I did an unboxing video, and I'll hawk my site. So you can go to flyingrich.com, and you can see my YouTube videos. I did an unboxing, and the cross-pollination here is I created, and for anybody that knows anything about 3D stuff, in Tinkercad, a case for the upboard. Because the first upboard, this is the upsquared, for the first upboard, they released an STL that you could print, and I did. I printed one for me and one for Dor. And what they did release this time around was an, I forgot what file, it was like an FBG, if I recall correctly, FBG file. And I don't, or I'm not fluid in any tools that work with FBG, and I found online conversion. So what I was able to do is convert it to an STL, upload it to Tinkercad, which is like the preschooler kind of online design tool.
I wouldn't say that. It's just very beginner friendly.
There is no menus, no buttons, and you do. It's kind of like the Apple way of doing things. And I hate to drink the Apple Kool-Aid, or I'm doing pretty good with that software, but I recognize its shortcomings, and I really need to learn something better. It's just that I got so good with this. The problem was when I converted the file over to an STL, it lost its scale. And I'd noticed that in the past with other things. So what I was able to do, I measured the 40-pin header with my caliper and then just made the 40-pin header that size. And
everything else snaps, right?
And I did a couple of sanity checks on ports on the other dimensions. So USB ports, whatever. I measured, you know, my USB ports here and measured there. And I'm like, okay, looks good. And the first pass on the case was real good. I mean, it's good enough to be 100% functional, which I'm shocked at. What I didn't realize is they put a big honking heatsink on the bottom. So then I thought that was going to be the bottom of the case, but it was the top of the case because you have the heatsink on top. And so from my design perspective, not like it made a lot of difference. So I made a big grilled cover for it, and it actually looks really good. So you can see that on my unboxing video. So if you, I'll hawk it again, flyingrich.com, go over there, you can see my YouTube videos. So I shot the footage for the second part of the video, or video two of the upboard, which is loading the OS. And so what I did is maybe I could have done this like a USB 3 stick and plugged it in and got it running a lot faster, but I had the the Ubuntu disk kicking around, and I just plugged the portable, you know, the USB DVD player into it and booted off of that. And I first did the live boot just to see that it would boot, and then I did the install from it. And the only thing is, you know, pretty standard BIOS, you know, pretty vanilla BIOS. Just go over to boot once you have your boot media plugged in. You got to boot with the boot media plugged in, and then select that as what you're going to boot from. And then it works fine.
My question, because this to me is a good indicator. Do you have a rough time-wise how long it took for the install to take? Like 15 minutes, 30 minutes?
Yeah, it might be a little bit more than 15 minutes. And what's the time mean to you if it takes that long?
Well, if it takes more than 15 minutes, it's just a slower disk I.O. or reading I.O. of the USB. Could be either or.
Oh, yeah, we're USB
2. If it takes half an hour, then it's really slow.
No. So, okay, I got, let's see, if I remember the config right, it's 8 gigs of RAM. It's a quad core. It, like, throttles or idles at 1.1 gigahertz, and it will go up to 2.5 under load. It's, I think, 64 gig eMMC, and it's running pretty decent. I haven't really, what I wanted to do is, what's kind of been holding me back is the reason I got the upboard 2 or upboard squared, is because it has two display ports. And my goal, if you've listened to the show more than once, you probably heard me talk about it, is I just want to plug it into two of my monitors. And while it's going to be running a full OS, I want it to be basically a thin client to my VMware virtual infrastructure of machines. So,
right. Yeah, the way I explain it to people is he wants it to be his captain's chair.
Yes.
Where all the command and control is done from. It's not where you monitor the actual engines at. It's where you communicate with where the engines are being monitored at. It's the portal.
Yes. Yeah. And to my dismay, it wasn't two HDMI ports. It's an HDMI port and a display port, which is like
I thought it was two HDMI.
I thought it was two HDMI. Maybe I was, you know, reading what I wanted to read.
Same here.
So I did get from Amazon an HDMI to DVI cable. And, you know, I grabbed, from the closet where I have stuff, another monitor. So now I have three monitors and my laptop on my desk. And I got a black screen.
Yeah, I'll say every single one of these converters, and I would grab one and hold it up, but I can't because I believe they're all being used right now. They're almost all the same type of manufacturing. They're not very long, and the one end is always fatter than the other, and it's either HDMI to VGA, HDMI to DVI, or one of these, you know, video to videos. They all cost the same, which I'm amazed by, because to do HDMI to VGA is literally an analog and a digital to analog conversion. Where just a couple years ago, they were $30-$40. Now you can get any kind of these converters for like $7. The problem becomes every time you do one of these, and this is what I found on many of my mini computers. Once you put that converter on, you go from like HDMI out of the Banana Pro or out of the upboard or out of the Raspberry Pi 2, no matter what you go to, you're not going to have the bidirectional communication that it seems like what happens on my normal desktop computer. I plug it in, it automatically senses the resolution, and sometimes it automatically pops.
Mm-hmm.
Once you put that on, there is no automatic communications going back and forth. Also, it seems like, let's say hypothetically, the upboard could display through DisplayPort 15 different possible resolutions. And that monitor might have 15 possible resolutions that are exactly the same. But because you have that converter on there, only three of them might actually work. And the thing is, you never know what they are. At least I can never find out what they are until I literally, like, load a desktop on the mini computer, VNC into it from another computer, and just keep switching the resolution until one clicks.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the one thing I hate about all these converters, but the sad truth is, we don't always have HDMI ports available to us or DVI ports available to us or whatever. You know, right. We almost always need these converters. And that's one trial and error thing that I don't like about these things.
Well, I'll have to dig a little deeper, but apparently Ubuntu doesn't have the DisplayPort drivers built into it. So,
yeah.
And I don't know if my monitor says there's no signal. So I don't know if I have a bad cable. And I asked my wife to take her laptop home from work that has a DisplayPort on it so I can just validate that the cable works. And she forgot. But the other thing is, I would have thought that if I went to the BIOS screen, you know, like I boot into the BIOS, that would drive also the DisplayPort, and it didn't.
Well, I'll say this, more than likely, and this is what I don't like either, because when you have multiple video outs like that, there can only be one or zero in the computing terms. Everything else is secondary.
Mm-hmm.
So the main one might be the only one that actually outputs BIOS level. And that's one of the other things. So what if it's HDMI that does that and not the DVI? Then you're even stuck even more, because then you can't verify if anything works.
So the other thing I did, and this is where I'm waiting for my friends to like jump out of helicopters and kick in my windows. I found a Windows 10 that would boot from USB. Yeah.
Excuse me. What did you say?
So, and my monitor's still dead.
I hate to say it. It makes me feel better. Because, I believe 1404, there was no DVI support without doing really special magic super sauce kind of thing. For all I know, 1604, there is some level of DVI support, but I still don't.
You're saying DVI, you mean DisplayPort.
I'm sorry, DisplayPort. I could be mistaken, but I don't think there still is support native in it. You might have to do some special downloads or installs for it. Now, because it's an Intel-based video chipset, I have to believe, it would be more likely for it to just work in Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
Not to work, but more likely.
Right.
So when you don't see Windows working on it, I have to believe Windows has it built in.
Yeah, this is kind of a kludgy version of Windows 10 designed to, you know, boot off an ISO and run. So a lot of the things that you would normally do, like I couldn't set up my Wi-Fi. It saw the adapter, but I couldn't configure it.
Oh.
So.
Well, I would just try to install Windows on it, seriously, just to see. I mean, because it's only a 15-minute process.
Yeah, I guess. And you know what it is? I kind of hang my head when you said that, because I started installing things I use. And for me, it usually takes about 8 weeks, because I don't do the same thing every day. I do the same thing every 2 months, 3 months. So it's going to be 2 or 3 months before I get all of the apps on it that I need to make it a daily driver.
Yeah, well, and the only thing, and I go through the same thing, and I used to always believe in doing full disk backups at times, so to make that reload process shorter, but nowadays, it's too much work even to do a backup, because it literally is a 10-15 minute install process, and then as I need it, I install it, and when I do need it, and I do install it, it only takes a minute. So I don't even go through the backup process anymore, just for full OS, for that reason alone. I'm almost tempted to say, how much did that, do you remember how much that converter, converter cost that you bought?
Oh, it wasn't a converter, it was a cable. It was like $7, I think.
Well, yes, I'm almost afraid to say, but it wouldn't shock me if you buy a $20 version, it will work.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it would then probably be able to support more resolutions.
Right. Might have the bidirectional communication going on.
And if it is a digital-to-digital conversion, HDMI to DisplayPort, it should be able to then, my logic,
do the bidirectional communication.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I would at least hope so. Now, the $7 one wouldn't shock me if it can't, because it's $7 kind of thing.
So the other thing that is kind of a slight bummer is there's no audio output. I guess the audio output would be coming down the HDMI or DVI.
Yeah. Same thing with the upboard one, the first upboard. There is no audio out. And it took me a while to figure that out, because I don't have any monitors with speakers built into them. And I do know that there is there are monitors out there you can buy with speakers being in them. But because monitors, to me, never seem to be fairly priced, as far as I'm concerned, they always seem a little bit higher from every monitor. And I mean from the Raspberry Pi 3-inch monitor
sure.
to a to a 31-inch desktop monitor. They all seem to be priced a little bit more than I would expect them to, but I'm sure if I had one with a speaker in it, the upboard, I'd hear the sounds just fine.
Well, I bought, they had a sale on techbargains.com, and I got the two Dell monitors super cheap 10 years ago. It was a very good deal for a pair of these Dell monitors, 21-inch monitors, and so I got two of them at a very good price.
Right. But that's why monitors cost more, because they can last.
Right. They're going to last, you know, at least two computers.
Yeah. So, I mean, I understand that, but the same token, then I'm ultra, I don't want to say hesitant, slow, methodical. Because I know they're going to last forever, I literally sometimes take 2 years to buy a new monitor, even when if I need one, just because I'll wait for the sale. I'll wait for the best deal I can find. And I did find a deal on eBay from Official Best Buy, 24-inch monitor, $75.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I popped. But now I got to get the bracket for multi-mount. I didn't realize that's $100, but we went way off track.
So, yeah, and actually I was looking at printing a bracket so I could stack my monitors vertically. I do have a partner desk, which is like dining room table sized, and I do like that because I do a bunch of stuff, and I'll shoot a lot of my unboxing videos or whatever videos that I do on the desk here. But now all of my desk is monitor. I still can see outside, which the way I have my office set up is so I can see into the house and I can see, you know, out in my front yard. So I have a good view of stuff other than office. And I don't want to block any of those views, which the unfortunate thing is it's a partner desk. Somebody could sit on the other side and we could have a conversation, but I got monitors in the way. And my dream would be have a massive freaking arm and the Hulk holding it, I guess, that would pivot, or it would pivot and fold so I could actually look at somebody on the other side of my desk.
Yeah, I understand completely. But we only have 3D printers now and CNC machines. We don't have metal forging stuff in our houses yet. We have two emails. I want to go over them. The first one is from Willem, which I'm pretty sure that's how he pronounced his name. Willem, this is the kind of email, if I could give a cash prize to, I would send this guy cash money. I only know about the ARM system what me and Jonathan Nadeau, like 3 years ago, were sitting in a hotel room drunk up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Let me preface that with, we were at a conference, so everybody was drunk. It wasn't just me and him. And we were talking about ARM stuff. And he said, well, the thing about ARMs is the naming convention is much different than normal x86 processors. And he explained some of it to me. So it all didn't stay with me. I've been half wrong with what I've been saying about ARMs with the lower numbers.
And I didn't want to correct you.
Well, you should have, damn it.
Because I wasn't too sure either. And I'll tell you why in a minute.
Well, yeah, because here's how I'm partially right. Okay. Willem says, on the show, you said for ARM numbers, the lower is the better. He said that's correct for ARM CPU/SOC system on a chip numbers. But ARM architecture numbers, the higher the better. When it says ARM V7, ARM V8, ARM V9, ARM V10, the higher number is better. He said, for instance, ARM V7 is 32-bit. That's it. ARM V8 is always 64-bit. And we all know 64 is better than 32 because it's twice as big.
So I didn't do any research on this. And hold on, here it is. The Orange Pi Zero Plus 2 comes in H3 and H5, and the H5 cost more, and that's the one I got.
Gotcha.
So that's where I was like, Dorr might not be right on this.
Yeah, and I will say it's the second set of numbers, which can be two or three digits, like the 57, 58, 78. Those numbers, I believe the number is partially the nanometer, which is why you want smaller numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So it can pack more processors on a smaller chip. Unfortunately, it means more heat, but also means faster processing. So you have to be very careful now. I'm going to have to be very careful when I look at ARM processors to correctly identify better or worse, because now there's two things I got to look at. The V number, which is basically the version number, and then the actual chip number. And I'm going to see if I can find a simple example here, especially like on Wikipedia, nudge, that goes through that to help better make this obvious for people like me. I'll try to have that in the notes. So thank you, Willem. There's one thing I love, and that's being right.
Or being corrected to right.
Yeah. And the next one, since this is show 51, it's very appropriate that we have a email from 5150. 5150 says, freedombox.org. I learned of this at Linux Fest Northwest conference up in the Bellingham, Washington area. Beautiful area. Fantastically nice people. 50 was just there maybe 3 weeks ago. And he said, and have been meaning to pass it along. This package is similar in concept to the Diet Pie. You can set up a number of servers from a web interface. In many cases, server configuration is greatly streamlined via the web interface. There are images on the site for many SBCs. It should be in the repos for any Debian, either x86, x64, or ARM Debian, because that's how Debian rolls. I thought of using the BeagleBone Black you gave me, but it might not be powerful enough to run multiple servers on it. So why did I miss that? So I'll try installing it under Debian on my Pine 64 first. That should be plenty powerful enough. And he says, I will let you know how that goes. By the way, my 14-inch Pinebook and my Mycroft AI should be on the way. 5150, signing off. The Mycroft is one of those trying to be Google Home, Alexa competitor, in-home devices that also hooks up with automation kind of things. I will be interested in 50's opinion on it and how he uses it. I will say the Pinebook, good luck, 50. Good luck. God bless you. I hope you get it soon. I will say, without sounding pompous or arrogant or cocky, because I really don't want to, but this is one of the things I find hysterical in a non-hysterical kind of way. The first time I saw FreedomBox and the first time I mentioned FreedomBox on any show was actually Linux for the Rest of Us, episode 34, back in 2011. FreedomBox has been around a hell of a long time. It's kind of focused and refocused its main objective over the years, but I'll tell you what one of the original objectives was: to give people the ability to own their content in a multi-node fashion and be able to communicate with friends and family in a Facebook-like setting. That was one of the things they were trying to shoot for, to where I could get an invitation from Rich's FreedomBox, and then I would connect to him. I would see his postings about going and meeting politicians. He would see my pictures of my kids, but it's on a server that we actually own and control.
I think I remember that.
Okay, but I'll say they went through a lot of changes. And if 50 didn't tell me, I wouldn't have went back and looked, because I had them in my tiny, tiny RSS feed reader. I have their news feed in there. And I go today and I find out the URL changed and my feed never got updated, so I didn't know. I will say FreedomBox is one of those things you gotta hit that network effect, or this is really almost pointless.
Mm-hmm.
I do think he is partially right with the own cloud like experience, because its goal is to have a purely web driven interface, and that's own cloud. Own cloud through the web interface, you can see the files, you can see the people, you can do calendaring, contacts, all kinds of stuff like that. So it's the same basic kind of concept, but it's more of, this is my digital vault of information, and I can share stuff out to you, honestly, really quickly in a link. They have stuff like Android apps and stuff. And I will say, going to the website, I can never find direct download links for X piece of hardware or X operating system. I mean,
it's under download.
Under download, I see About Us, Manual, Wiki, About Us, Contact, FreedomBox Foundation, Source Code, Participate, Donate. Oh man, right in front of me, download.
Yeah, you mean that blue link in the middle of the page?
In the middle, just looking at me. Okay, so yeah, they do have BeagleBone Black listed on here. Now it is in testing. Now here's the thing, you ready?
Everything's in testing.
QB truck testing, QB board 2 testing, BeagleBone Black testing, A20 Olenix Eno testing, another one testing, Dream Plug testing, Raspberry Pi testing, Raspberry Pi 2-3 testing, testing, which is fine.
Do they need a little animated guy, the GIF with the guy digging on the yellow sign?
Which, at least they're upfront about it. That's the good thing. But they've been basically in testing for 10 years. I don't know what it's going to take for these guys to get good traction. I don't know what it's going to take for these guys to get contributors to push them over the edge. I don't know what it's going to take for that kind of thing to happen. I would love for it to happen, though. I would like to try it, but thankfully, they even have a VirtualBox 64 and 32-bit version if you just want to put it in a VM and what it is and play with it. Yeah,
the ability to spin it up.
Right, so that's what I'm going to end up doing. They also have QEMU versions, good on them. 32-bit x86 version, so if you just want to run it on native old hardware kind of thing. So that's good. The only thing I don't like is I don't see any Odroid support, and right. Odroid.
Yeah, they have Raspberry Pi, and I don't know what the other ones are other than the BeagleBone.
This is the kind of thing I want to see take off like a bottle rocket, but me wanting it alone is not going to be enough. I'm going to play with it. It sounds free. I don't know what it would take for me to replace my own cloud right now, or what I would really like to be running is Nextcloud, but that's for a different day because I don't have the time to do it. But I don't know what it would take for me to get away from it. But I can tell you, with OwnCloud, I can give anybody on Windows, Mac, or Linux a installable link. They can install it on their desktop like Dropbox, point it to a folder, and have automatic syncing. I don't see that on their systems. Because my guess is they want every point to be its own individual node.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has to be an administrator. You know what I mean? Some people don't want to be administrators. Some people just want to be clients.
Right. Not everybody's a geek like us.
Yeah, so I like the idea of this. I would really like it to get more traction. I'd really like, honestly, you be able to go into I want it to be so user-friendly, I want to walk into a store, Best Buy, and see, here, buy a Freedom Box all in one, but of course, you can't call it Freedom Box in public because they won't get it. So I will have to check this out again. Thank you very much, 5150, for the reminder that this thing exists. The one thing I wanted you to talk about, Rich, I did notice doing the Maker podcast that we on this show, I don't want to say have been ignoring or forgetful kind of thing, but we have not done a good job with coming back repetitively to beginner type topics to remind people, just coming into this, how to do stuff. I don't know about you, Rich, one of the earliest things that I ever did with mini computers that made me want to quit and not do it anymore was trying to get operating systems on micro SD cards or flashing the OS image to a card. I had so many failures in the beginning. I swore it was me. I swore it was my hardware. I swore it was a bad SD card. I swore it was Linux even. So I had lots of pains in this. You, on the other hand, at least have in the past used one of the completely cross-platform solutions.
Right. So I'm not sure when I got turned on to Etcher. It's etcher.io, and the kind of catchy. I like how they do things. Their slogan is burn better, and it runs on every OS. So, Mac, Linux, Windows, and my daily driver is a Mac, and I was trying to do it from the command line when I first started this, DDIFOF kind of stuff, and I had all sorts of issues, and I wasn't doing it right. So whenever I burned a micro SD card, I'd grab a netbook from, let's see, what year was that? 2007, 2008, and fire it up in Windows XP and, USB thumb drive the image over and then plug the SD card into the slot, or the micro SD into the SD card slot adapter, that kind of thing. It was always a big deal. And there are some special cases where you need another tool. I believe when you do an Android OS, they want you to use another tool. Do you remember what that was, Dor?
No, but I can tell you why they need you to use a other tool.
Why?
I believe it's block size.
Oh, okay.
Because that's one thing I don't see in the Etcher interfaces. I don't see you having the ability to select block size.
Yeah, the Etcher interface is more Mac world-ish. Basically, you select an image, you select a device that you want to go to, and you click burn. And, you know, there's right. three steps. You know, it's kind of nice interface, works real good. And then if you want to burn the same image again, it's like, hey, burn the same one. And, you know, you can say yep or nope. And pick another image.
Well, yeah, and it also says it has the ability to validate.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it does a validate after every burn. So real good software. I have had zero issues with it whatsoever.
Yeah, and it does say it's made with JavaScript, HTML, Node.js, Electron. What they don't tell you, and this is what I think, well, I don't understand, because I actually had back and forth with a developer. This is Flash. Mm-hmm. They don't tell you for some reason it's using Flash.
Flash is a no-no.
But I believe if I download it on my Linux desktop and run it, it ain't going to work.
Oh, because you need Flash?
Unless I go back and install Flash. I could be mistaken. Maybe they've changed it since then, because it has been a couple months since I communicated with them. But if you are confident in your computer, I say if you want an easy tool, this cannot be touched. Okay, this cannot be touched. On Windows, you have WinDisk32 mm-hmm. Imager, which is a pretty easy tool. Well, compared to this tool, that tool is ridiculously complex. You know what I mean? Because this literally is just click, click, click. It's like a wizard kind of process, and it does look really good. And I'm really happy he made this tool, because I've had friends of mine get into the Raspberry Pi world, and then they say, well, I don't understand why this damn thing ain't booting. And, you know, they keep, like me, questioning, well, maybe I need a different SD card.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe this cable's bad. And then when I do break down and tell them, okay, just use Etcher. Oh, okay, that worked. So it is a really good tool. If you want simplicity, it's hard to beat. I will just say, if you don't have Flash installed on your computer, I believe you're going to have to install Flash. And if you're okay with that, then go ahead and check this tool out. You can download portable versions for Windows as well, which I will say, on Windows, I really like portable apps versus apps you have to actively install. Oh, and they do have a dev package. So if I'm on a Debian-based system, that tells me it should have automatic dependency resolution. So if I install it through that way, then it should all install everything that it needs. So that's good. Very cool. Yeah. Now, here's the thing. How many times in your early process did you have problems making SD cards? Because I'll tell you right now, on every board, it seems like I got to burn 3 or 4 times before I get it working.
Yeah, I've had some different issues. It's been a while since I've had an issue, because I guess between Etcher and whatever else I've been using, everything works. So I've matured out of that process and didn't retain all of the legacy bad things.
Gotcha. Because of my, I don't want to say paranoia, but because I don't want anything to go wrong, I am basically stuck in buying only one kind of cards, and they are SanDisk Ultra cards, which are basically the fastest micro SD card you can get, because I will say speed on these micro SD cards will directly affect your performance on all of these devices.
Correct.
Even the cheapest of the cheapest mini computers will run better when you use a better card. So I will only buy these SanDisk Ultras. And because I'm a Linux weenie, I will not buy bigger than a 32 gig card.
Okay. I got to jump in on something here. So yeah. Hold on.
And I don't want to pay the Microsoft tax.
Yeah. If you get bigger than 32 gig, you got to pay a Microsoft tax?
Yeah.
That's rough. Yeah.
Every time a device, and here's the thing, every time a device is sold that can read more than 32 gig SD cards, the IEEE agreed you would then have XFAT built into it. XFAT is a Microsoft-owned
mm-hmm.
format, and mm-hmm. they know how much they screwed up with FAT32, how much mm-hmm. money they lost. So they did this one differently. So every time you buy a piece of hardware that can support more than a 32 gig card, Microsoft gets some money. And anytime you buy a micro SD card that's bigger than 32 gig, Microsoft gets some money.
Oh.
And my logic is, if I need more than 32 gigs on a micro SD card, I am doing something wrong.
Hmm.
Because that's plenty of space. Plenty. I don't have terabyte files. I don't have 200 gig files.
And you know, there's been various things like this in the past. Like cassette tapes, I don't know about 8 tracks in the day, but VCR tapes, they're always adding a fee on because there was some form of piracy that you were going to record your, you know, LP onto a cassette tape and play it in your car and not buy another LP for your car. You know, that kind of thing. And even hard drives, they're doing the same thing about music and videos on hard drives. So they are paying, I don't know if it's RIAA or MPAA, for all of the space. So they're all getting a cut. They're just finding a new revenue stream. Because I don't think they're making any money on cassette tapes anymore. The thing that I grabbed is the Orange Pi IoT device. And I looked up on, a website. I don't remember the website right now. It said that it has an FM radio on it. So not only is it Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GMRS, whatever, you know, it's basically 2G cell phone. Apparently it has an FM radio on it also, which I just found crazy cool. I have not been able to get this to boot. So the couple interesting things. So it says it needs an 8 gig class 10 micro SD card to boot.
Right.
And because if it's bigger, it's going to use too much power. It's going to need less power if it's an 8 gig, which I've never heard, but that's what their documentation says. And okay. I'll have to reread their documentation again, but it also said that, you know, this device is Wi-Fi, and, you know, I plugged a USB to Ethernet adapter in, and I didn't get any action on it. So apparently, the OSs you download are pre-designed. If you have a hotspot, you know, your access point called Orange Pi with a password of Orange Pi, it'll automatically connect to that, and then you can SSH into the darn thing. But what I did do is I bought the TTL to USB adapter, which is why I fired up my laptop in Windows and to see if I could get it to connect, and I kept just cycling through the device manager, so I couldn't get the port that the adapter was on to connect to it. But that, and then I went on a hunt, and I'd find these 8 gig micro SD cards that were class 10, and they'd want $20 and $30 for them. I'm like, I'm not paying that. Not going to happen.
So, I mean, did you go on Amazon or someplace and buy one?
I haven't bought it yet. I did buy this adapter for like $6, and I was hoping to be able to, you know, see some output. And this has a eMMC on it also. I forgot if it's 256 meg or 500 meg, but it also has eMMC, which I was kind of shocked at because I have the... Let's see, it's the Orange Pi Zero 2 Plus H5, and the base H5 doesn't, it has an HDMI port, and the power port, you know, the micro B is an OTG port. So if you had an OTG Y cable, you could power and get, an, you know, a USB port off it. But I did have the HAT with the other IOs and two USBs, etc. And I had put Octopi on this because I just feel bad using a Raspberry Pi 3 as an Octopi printer server. Although this is nearly as much, and forget about the time I invested if I paid myself $1 an hour to do it.
Right. Yeah, I personally believe Octopi's load, which I now understand the word load a little bit better on computing terms, I have to believe the load from Octopi on a Raspberry Pi 3. A Raspberry Pi 3 has to be overkill. Has to be overkill.
All right. So what I noticed is when I tried running Octopi on a Raspberry Pi Zero, my temperatures weren't getting maintained. So we're talking about a lot of real-time stuff that's happening. So As feed rates increase or decrease, then your temperatures are going to, increase and decrease. As more filament is put through the heater nozzle, it's going to require more energy to keep it at the right temperature. And I saw, easy 10 degree dip in what the temperature should be versus what it was when I didn't have Octopi, when I didn't have the Pi Zero running Octopi hooked up. And I did see a slight bit. Now, it could be like a little bit of tuning I have to do on my printer, but I did see a few degrees temperature underrun as opposed to when I was running without Octopi with the Raspberry Pi 3. But Raspberry Pi 2, Raspberry Pi 3 should be fine on your 3D printer. I haven't had any print issues.
Right. Well, I'll say going from the Raspberry Pi 3 to the Raspberry Pi Zero is like a quad drop down.
More than that.
Yeah. So my logic is there has to be something. I don't want to say in the middle, but I would think if you could get a Raspberry Pi 2 for $15, my logic is Raspberry 2 would probably be perfectly acceptable for
right.
it. Or something equivalent. You know what I mean? But to me, I am going to get a 3D printer, and I am going to probably just stick a Raspberry Pi 3 on it for simplicity's sake, just to make sure everything's up and running and smooth. Then when I start to really get to know Octopi intimately, I might change out the boards, but not.
Oh, and I got to say thank you. I'm going to say thank you to Door publicly, because Door kind of intercepted me when I was going for the most complex route to solve a problem. I don't think I talked about this on any show yet, but I was like, okay, I got some Cat 5 running in the rafters, and if I put a Wi-Fi access point up there and tee the line off to the alarm system and then, run power over Ethernet, I'm like, oh no, but that doesn't have, it only has one in, one out, and the one's for WAN, and I'm going through all, I'm like, all right, so I'll have to put a switch and the access point up there. I'm going through all of these conniptions, and then you just said, don't you have a power over Ethernet converter? I'm like, yeah. He's like, why don't you try that out? Plug it in, the damn thing worked. And it even worked, this better yet. I got this big honking UPS hooked up to my 3D printer. So even on the back, after whatever filtering it does, it still worked. And nice. It worked real good. So thank you, thank you, thank you, because I was on my way to a multi-hour fuster cluck that just wasn't going to end up right and wasn't going to work.
Yeah, the two technologies I've never used, but I know can be unbelievably helpful and useful for a myriad of situations, are Ethernet over power and power over Ethernet. Both of them can really take situations that are really hard, really difficult, and just simplify them down. With Ethernet over power, you don't get crazy speeds, but from everyone I know, you get a solid connection that's at least like 50 megs. So you might not be able to stream 4K video over Ethernet over power, and I always got to stop before I say that. Ethernet over power, you can get a good connection to it. And with these kind of services that we do, you don't need, 4K resolution. You just need connectivity. And then power over Ethernet means someplace off in a corner where you would have to run a, 100-foot extension cord. You don't have to. You can just run one Ethernet cable, and you get both networking and power.
Yeah, and that's precisely what I'm doing. I'm actually doing both. So for my backyard access point, I have a 100-foot Ethernet cable, and I have this access point all the way at the back of the house and at the rafters. And basically, that gives my backyard the pool area, and more importantly, my shed where my PiaWare is running, my lawn shed, and that gives it the connectivity. But the power, let's see, Ethernet over power works real good. And so two things about the Octopi. You plug a webcam into it and you now stream your print. So you can see what's going on. You can stream it to your friends, like all of us geek out looking at what each other's printing. And I also have push bullet set up. So basically, it's like getting an SMS message, a text message. And at the end, it'll give you a text message that the print is done and an image of it, which Unfortunately, because where my bed moves, it moves to its zero position. It moves whatever's on the bed out of view. So I get a, you know, just a blank picture showing up.
Gotcha. I will say, push-pull is one of those niceties. You don't know if you need it, and you might think, I don't need it. But I encourage you, if you play with it, you might find it's a great solution. It's the kind of thing where you can send and receive the text messages on your phone from any desktop computer, just logging into Pushbullet. It then can do the bi-directional thing to where in Octoprint you can say, when complete, send it to this Pushbullet account, where it isn't really an account. You have to copy over a
key.
Like a cert.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that makes that kind of thing easier. Octoprint is one of those, and we did have at least one friend who was like, you run Octoprint? Why would you run Octoprint? What does that do? That doesn't sound very smart. That seems like a waste of time. Why would you do that? And we just kept badgering him. And then after like 2 weeks, he finally, you know, went and installed it. He was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. Yeah, we know. We've been complaining to you for now weeks to do it. So if you do have a 3D printer, it's literally like turning your lawnmower into a Ferrari. Yes, they both have four wheels. Yes, they both move, but they are completely different experiences, one versus the other. Octoprint is the way to go. There is no ifs, ands, maybes, buts, could bes, or should bes. It is.
Well, in the way I'm using Octoprint, I'm just scratching the surface on it because the Pushbullet is a plugin and pretty easy to install. Their plugin architecture is real nice. You can do a bunch of different things. You can actually have the slicer. And this is, I don't know if this is more, you know, printer tech as opposed to mini PC tech, but you can have the slicer on that. So you just add the STL file to it and it will do the slicing and print it. Another cool thing. So having a video camera on it gives you certainty of what's going on without always checking it. So if, like me, I can VPN into my home network. I also opened up the port for the streaming of the video. So I shared it with, you know, my friends so they can see what I'm printing. The cool thing about that is you can see if you had a malfunction of any kind, that the print is still working, it's going well.
Right.
You could be in your office on a conference call. You could have woken up at 2 a.m. and be in bed and just pull up the URL on your browser and not leave, you know, roll over, know that the printer is going, you know, that 72-hour print you're doing is just fine.
Yeah, the dream is to have my printer finish, have something bump the print off the printer, and then be able to start another print. That's the dream, which I keep being told by everyone, keep dreaming, it ain't going to happen. People have been trying to do this for years, and it just doesn't happen. But, you know, I would like to have it. And I will say, you have to open up the port on your firewall to get this stuff on the outside. We are looking at a way, and I got to figure it out. And if you guys out there have any ideas, minipcshowponus.com, tell me. I don't want to give up Rich's home WAN IP address. I don't want to give up Aaron, another guy in the show, his public-facing WAN IP address. But I want to find a way where I can take the feeds from all the people on the show, from their Octoprints video feeds.
Oh, that's cool. And aggregate them.
And aggregate them to where we can have like a four-way combo box of the active feeds right now. I'm afraid to do it on a DigitalOcean droplet because I'll be using, essentially, you know, like if I stream my video up, I'm going to, and then we have three other people doing it, I'm going to be using 8 times the bandwidth, okay, initially, because I'm going to have 8 feeds coming in and 4 feeds coming in and 4 feeds going out. Every single person that watches that feed, that's more bandwidth going out the server. And that's where services like DigitalOcean and Amazon EC2 and Rackspace, that's where they get you on the amount of bandwidth that you use. So I can't host this on a DigitalOcean droplet because the price would be phenomenal.
Now, my hosting, I have unlimited everything.
I'm sure they tell you that, but I'm also sure if you use 20 terabytes in a month, they're going to freak out on you.
Yeah.
I have unlimited too on Podnuts, and they do complain. They do not like the amount of disk space I use, and they do not like the amount of bandwidth I use per month, because most months it's over 10 terabytes.
Oh my gosh, wow.
So they don't like that, but I remind them, in my plan, it states this. Now, if you're having other customers having issues because of my bandwidth, just tell me. And then I'll ask for documentation showing me that, and then I'll move to a higher service. But they literally want me to move from a service which is, I want to say, $300 a year up to about $115 a month.
Ow. Ow.
Yeah. So I'm not making that jump. They're going to have to, you know, twist my arm. But again, I digress. I want to talk about this one link. That sounded, no. I want to talk about this link you put in the show, Rich, line 440. And it's from The Verge, which I will say, first off, I'm shocked we are bringing anything from The Verge to of all shows, this show.
I forget what podcast I was listening to, but I heard the concept of The Verge. It's like, oh yeah, they're going to talk tech stuff, but without technical information. I'm like,
what's the point of that? Yeah,
it's kind of like, I'm going to build this Ferrari, but it's not going to look good, handle good, or go fast. Like,
right. Right. We're going to play sports, but no one's going to win. We're going to do it for the fun.
And there'll be no teams.
Okay. It basically is saying in the article, ARM's new processors are designed to power the next generation machine learning machines. And I'll say, to me, this is actually kind of big, because we just had Intel announce their next generation i9 processor, which, let me tell you something, the amount of power that thing's going to suck down and the amount of heat that thing's going to give off is going to be phenomenal. But if you can afford the setup for it, I salute you. You're going to enjoy that i9.
Well, how many cores is the i9? You can get it. Is it like 6 and 12 cores?
Yeah, I believe it was 6 and 12, yeah. Yeah, okay, fine. They can do that. Intel has always been, in my opinion, more towards the powerful desktop, crazy laptop type of processor architecture. That's where they shine. That's where they do best. That's where they crushed AMD, okay? ARM seems to be going, I don't want to say in the opposite direction, but they're definitely trying to hit a different market. And this is very smart of them, okay? We all keep constantly hearing AI. We all constantly keep hearing machine learning. Dirty secret, they're the same thing. But here's how I define machine learning. Back in the day, we would have an application. The for instance I'm going to use is search engines. We would have an application called a spider. We would send out to a website. It would collect information. It would bring information back, and it would bring it into the machine. We would then have separate applications and processes doing the reorganization, the re-indexing, the algorithms, the rankings of the thing. Then we would have a different stack doing the input of the search request, the recording of all the searches that happened, then putting them all into priority and everything else. Machine learning, to me, and I've watched now in the last couple of weeks 20 plus hours of content on this, machine learning to me seems to be nothing more than the semi-automated process of that type of thing from beginning to end and then back again. So it's a never-ending machine of, we're going to get information off The Verge, we're going to bring it in, The Verge is doing pretty good, people are searching for The Verge, people are clicking on The Verge because we now have Google Chrome, people are staying on The Verge. So because of that, go back to the spider, and now let's more intelligently scrape and scan in a deeper fashion The Verge to give those people the more information that they desire. It's a self-fulfilling, prophecy kind of thing. Machine learning is closing the loop of the development process kind of thing, you know, bringing it all the way back around again. And ARM, here's the thing. Intel has its own processor set and its own basically commands against the processor. We as end users never know this, okay? Microsoft has to write their kernel explicitly for x86 Intel-based type processor, or I can't remember what it's called, but the ARM is called RISC processing. Can't remember the word. So they're basically two different sets of commands. Okay, the ARM command set is much more small commands with small instructions with small tasks being done. Intel is doing the big crazy computations all in one fell swoop. So there are different sets of commands. Not only is ARM going to have to point toward machine learning machines, but they're going to have to basically create the bases of APIs for IDEs, for development processes for machine learning. They're going to have to make sure that they have this stuff wide open. ARM has, to me, a great opportunity here. We all know Google Home, Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant on our phone, Siri, Cortana, and all those kind of things are only going to become more popular. And the more ARM can make it easier for all those developers to do this machine learning kind of thing, the more likely ARM will be even more powerful in the future, being more competitive with Intel, because that's what I want. I want to see hardcore competition, like beat the crap out of each other competition.
Well, and of course, competition is always good for the end user, because you keep making things better. And whether it's auto racing and auto manufacturers, and I could go on and on about supercars and hypercars, but there was an article that we read a couple weeks back, and it was about like data center ARMs, where they have 16 cores in a chip.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's crazy a lot power going on. There were a number of these articles that kind of dovetail together that print a very interesting picture.
Yeah. The one line in here that they have highlighted in the article, which also I caught, was ARM marketing. So he's a marketing guy. Okay, so take this with a grain of salt, because he's a marketing guy, which means he gets paid to lie, because that's what marketing is, from big companies. But it says ARM marketing chief John Ronco says he anticipates a 50 times improvement in AI per performance over the next 3 to 5 years. That's substantial. Okay, 50 times improvement. 50 times improvement? We typically only see 2 to 3 times improvement over 12 months, 18 months, 2 years. He's saying next 3 to 5, a 50 times improvement. If this is even remotely close to accurate, we are going to see much more appliance-like mini computing devices. Because let's be honest, ARM in a desktop or in a laptop still seems really hard to nail down to get to that really usable state. ARM in mini appliances, it's a given. It's the way to go. Yeah, this just looks good. And I'm really liking some of the latest ARM processors that I've gotten in my house and their performance, like the Odroid X U4, which you've had a couple issues with in the last couple weeks, haven't you?
Yeah. So one of the things I didn't realize, I'm kind of embarrassed, and I think one of the problems is what was I running for Observium? I don't have Observium running anymore. So it's a network monitoring tool and SNMP monitoring. And what it'll do is it'll monitor heat on the CPU, disk space available, RAM available, that kind of thing. So I ran out of disk space on my Odroid. And then I guess I cleared it up. Life happened. Just I happy-go-luckily saw that there was a Diet Pi update, and being a big Diet Pi lover, I'm like, oh, let's do the update. The update, like, blew my MBR. I'm like, oh, great. And so the Odroid, I have booting off the eMMC. So I had to do real frickin' brain surgery. And if you blow the MBR, so what I did is I backed up the MBR. I pulled it out, and I copied it onto, I think, a hard drive on one of my computers, on a Linux computer. And then I formatted it, and I put the Android OS on it, because that's where the MBR comes from. That's their process. And I do have a YouTube video on this, and which I actually went back to so I could remember everything. And then I annotated it with the correct links to the tools. So I was able to put the Android OS back on, and I was able to put the image back on and not lose anything. So I was very happy. And then I didn't do a DF, which I normally do, and I kept like, this isn't working right. This process didn't boot. What's going on with it? Finally figured out, like, oh, okay, all of the torrents are getting downloaded to the eMMC, and it's full. So I deleted them, cleared them away. And even though in, let's see, is it Transmission or Deluge? I'm using Deluge. So in Deluge, all of the config files, there's like a JSON file where the config is, points to one of the USB 3 hard drives, 4 terabyte, 5 terabyte drive. For some reason, it's still picking the boot drive. And I finally solved it by putting a symlink in and saying, hey, fine, you want it right here? I'm good with that. But it's going to the hard drive. And so the symlink, and if you guys don't know what that is, it's a symbolic link. And basically what it is a pointer, and it points to another location. So if, even though I have all the configs set right, it still wants to write there. If it still wants to write there, it'll write there. It'll think it's writing there, but really it's writing to where I want it to write on the hard drive with the symbolic link. So just look up symbolic link in Linux or Ubuntu and you'll see what it is. The other thing that started happening is it's very funny. I'm kind of an awkward bird. I don't watch TV, and for the most part, I don't watch any video or anything like that. I do go to sleep, and I need some noise in the background to sleep. Well, I had a bunch of videos, and I got the current season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on my Plex server. And, you know, I'd fall asleep. Next morning, you know, I'd go to do something on the Odroid. The other thing the Odroid does is it backs up the Macs in the house. And I'd see, hey, you know, the time capsule backup failed. I go to ping it or SSH into it, and it's, like, unresponsive. And I walk over to the data center in a drawer, which I have a YouTube video, and I see the fan on high, and it's just unresponsive. So I got to, you know, pull the power out, recycle it. What I ended up finding is there's two settings. One setting was for the video quality, and I turned the video quality down. And as improper scientific method goes, I also changed the maximum number of streams that'll transcode simultaneously to like 4 or 5. And I don't have any... it looked like it was an overheating problem. I, you know, did a screen capture on a, you know, playing a video, looking at the thermal and, you know, the thermal values on the CPUs, and running HTOP to see what was taking up all of the processes. And the thing almost immediately went to 95C. And I actually did send the video, you know, it's a privately linked video, to Ameridroid, and they got back to me. They said, you know, it is designed to, you know, it'll peak on the temperature, then start throttling the CPU, and that really wasn't the answer I was looking for, because it wasn't quite constructive. It wasn't going to lead me to a solution. But in the meantime, I figured out, like, hey, if I turn down or limit the maximum video resolution and limit the maximum number of streams, it'll transcode simultaneously. I don't have those issues. I haven't since run a thermal test on it like I did for the video, but I probably ought to do that again just to prove what I did do was correct.
Yeah, just to be sure. I will say these processors honestly can take more heat than some people think, is what I would say. I am ultra wary when I see my temperature go up, and I hate to say it, but when I log in to my DietPi interface via SSH, and I see the temperature number in red.
Yes.
Well, it's red for a reason, isn't it?
Yes.
Red means bad. So when I see that on mine, I completely get worried and freak out. Like,
yeah, it has a nice message that says you're doing damage to the processor, or you're limiting the lifespan of the processor.
Yes, exactly. I will say my first knee-jerk reaction was definitely lower the resolution. And that's really only just to validate it will go down. Because my logic is, even if you just lower the resolution down like one notch in the Plex interface, every notch is an exponential less of processing being done, because there's less pixels. There's that many less pixels.
Right, it's a square.
Notch. Right, inverse square coming back down. So you should see a performance increase with that, because that's what I kept doing when I was trying Plex upstairs on the Odroid C2. I would take the resolution down as far as it could go, play it. And when it played good, bump it up one. Play good, bump it up one, until I started to see it act bad. What I couldn't understand was then when I loaded up a Samba share on my server here downstairs, and on my Odroid via Kodi just said, add this new path, SMB:// IP address of the server, share name, and then do it. I could do it in much higher resolution.
Oh, that's wild. So you think the protocol difference took up less, was less CPU intensive or better optimized?
Well, I don't want to say better optimized, but something on one of the ends was mm-hmm. better optimized for that protocol, because there's no way Plex, with auto-sensing bandwidth, being able to adjust, can right. be beat by Samba. So there's something weird, I'll say, either sure. on the Android OS or whatever. But I was shocked at the performance I was getting off of SMB connections with my connection. But that Plex interface is not replaceable by anything, at least I found in Kodi. My Kodi interfaces I saw were not family-friendly enough to work.
Ah, hmm.
Yeah, because like my kid likes being able to go in to the Plex interface, pick. He's watched King of Kong a couple times and a couple video game related movies I have. And he's watched, I have the entire Dungeons and Dragons from the 80s cartoon with the Dungeon Master on DVD. He's watched them a couple times too. And asking him to go through the Kodi interface, he even said to me, "It's a lot of work to get there, Dad." Meaning there's a lot of clicks.
Yeah, the Kodi interface isn't that intuitive. And for those of you not in the know, One Plex is like your own home version of Netflix.
But it also has the plus to where you can then connect to your best friend's copy of Netflix and see all the stuff that he has on his too.
Yeah, and actually Dor's sharing with me and I'm not sharing with Dor, and I gotta remedy that.
I'm not stressed.
The other thing is, if you're using my favorite operating system in the world, DietPie, and I got to tell you one more thing about DietPie. DietPie to add Plex is just a checkbox. Now, you should go into the interface and configure it. And I did configure a third thing. So instead of just changing one variable at a time for a good scientific method, I changed three. Yeah. And because when I was running on the Banana Pi M3, and that was very OS sensitive, it would not run, I forget what OS it was, and when I put the unofficial version of DietPie on it, it did run properly. Whether the CPU or GPU are getting loaded, and how they're effectively or efficiently running, and that was a problem on, I forget which OS it was, but the unofficial version of DietPie was good. So when I had a problem, I've been using Twitter to contact the guys at DietPie, and they respond sometimes within a few minutes, which is, I'm just shocked. And I mentioned to him, I said, "Hey, you know, I just upgraded to version 1.5.0 on my Odroid XU4, and I was out of space, and you know, really, you know, gave me trouble because it blew my MBR, etc." The guy's like, "Oh yeah, 150 has that version, so 150 will check for available space and only do the update if you have enough room. So when you go from 150 to 151, that'll work." So they already fixed the problem, but unfortunately, it wasn't for that version.
Ah, damn. Okay, well, here's the question I have for you, Rich. I do have an Odroid XU4
mm-hmm.
that I honestly got as a gift from, I'm embarrassed to say right now, the name is slipping my mind, even though I was playing with this last night, and I was saying to myself, thanks to him, because this thing's working really well. But I've never flashed it. I've never installed anything on it. Okay. It does have an eMMC on the bottom, ready to roll, ready to rock and roll. So to install DietPie to the eMMC, what I have to do is I have to do some, what I call shell game tactics.
Correct.
I have to take a microSD card, put the OS that I want installed to the eMMC on that SD card.
Correct.
Boot to that
MMC. Nope. You already did it wrong.
Boot to that SD card.
You already did it wrong.
How so?
Disconnect the eMMC? No, there's a switch.
There's a physical switch. I thought the physical... there's a physical switch right there that says...
SD.
Man, my eyes are bad. Yes, SD. So I have to then flick the switch to SD.
Correct.
Keep the MMC connected.
Right.
Boot to the microSD card with that operating system I want on the MMC.
No, you first have to go, and my YouTube video covers this, you first have to load the Android. Android has the MBR.
So no matter what I want to end up with, I have to first load Android. Okay, now here's where there's going to be a problem. Because to install Android to a microSD card is a finicky thing.
All right, I believe I used Etcher for it this time.
Okay, well, then I might have to end up downloading Etcher. I use G-Disk Dump, which I've had success with on everything except some Androids. So I'm going to have to play with that.
Yeah, I'm going to my YouTube to take a look.
So then is there an app in their Android that will let me...
All right, you actually don't do anything.
I got to do something.
No, all you have to do is you put Android on the microSD with it switched over to microSD with the eMMC plugged in,
right,
and Android writes itself to the eMMC.
Okay, but what if I don't want to run Android? I want to run
That's
Diapod.
Fine. That's what you got to do first.
Right, so that's no matter what, default step one.
So that's what you got to do first. That'll get you the eMMC. I'm sorry, the MBR on the eMMC. And MBR is Master Boot Record. I know I'm talking this stuff, and Dor and I know what we're saying. Once you get the MBR over there, then you can throw DietPi on and get it over. And actually, I'll send you this link in the chat.
Okay, well, my question is when I install Android to the SD card, or I flash Android to the SD card, boot up, is there an APK or is there an application in the Android I click to copy it over to the eMMC?
No, it just does it.
Or is there a terminal I have to pull up?
Nope.
Which is automatically
just does it.
You got to do nothing.
Nothing.
Okay, so then it installs on the, just for booting, it installs on the MMC.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm done. Then I pull out the SD card. I reflash the SD card to DietPi, for instance. Put it on the SD card. Put the SD card back in the thing. Boot to that.
Yes.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can remove the SD card, flick the switch, voila.
Correct.
Okay. I'm going to try to do that here before next week because I've been going back and forth. I communicate with the DietPi people as well on Twitter, and they got back with me in 20 minutes or whatever.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I said, and this was a test. I literally went to test these guys, push them, prod them without trolling them, obviously. I wanted to troll them. I literally saw on the Nextcloud website, Nextcloud 12 launched, and it was literally for like an hour earlier. So I went on Twitter, and I said, hey, DietPi, when are you guys going to put Nextcloud 12 into DietPi? The guy replied with, I didn't even know it was out yet. And I sent them a link to it. He said, oh, well, we'll have it in version 150 that should be out in like 3 or 4 days. I was like, damn. Okay, so I was going to put Android on the X4U, take it upstairs, do a little switcheroo with the family, change the XBMC from Kodi Master to, I believe it's called Pulse, maybe, is the plugin that everyone is saying is now the new hotness, works great, blah, 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 blah. And then bring the Odroid down here and play with that one. But now, because there's Nextcloud 12 on DietPi, I'm tempted to install that on the X4, get it configured, get it up and running, get the user accounts copied over,
uh-huh,
and warn everybody who's connected to it that they're going to have to redo their applications.
Okay, I may have lied to you. I'm just looking at this page. I threw it in the chat, so you ought to include it in the show notes. The last line here says, run copy uboot _SD2EMMC. So it looks like, this is why I blog and I do videos, because I do something and it's in my head when I do it and then it's out of it. And
well, this says, okay, yeah, okay, sorry.
So I said, when I had to redo my Odroid XU4, I watched the video over again that I made.
Gotcha. Make sure I got the note. Should be over there, over there. Over there. Okay. So this is for the X3, XU3, and the
XU4. XU4, correct.
Okay. I'm trying to just see in the notes where it says that. Oh.
All the way on the bottom.
So you basically have to load up a terminal,
mm-hmm,
in Android and just say run space copy _U boot.
No, that's not Android when you boot the new OS.
Oh, so I don't need the Android.
No, when you do, the Android only puts the MBR on.
Okay. Well, it's already running something from the eMMC just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm then going to guess I don't have to do the MBR again.
Correct.
Okay. So that's good. So I don't have to do that. So that's good. Okay. Run, copy, uboot, SD, the eMMC. Okay. Also, it comes with a predefined script right there, ready to rock and roll. Okay. So that's what I'm going to probably end up doing. I might still end up doing Android just to swap it out, because once in a while, the family's complaining that, the movies aren't They keep buffering kind of thing.
And just as a reminder, I think I mentioned this before, because with another device, I think it was the original Orange Pi Zero, I tried the Android OS on it, and it's in Chinese. So what I did is I held my phone with Google Translate open, you know, the visual Google Translate, because I had no idea where the language settings were. So I could navigate around, get to where the language settings were, and change it to English.
Gotcha. Hey, whatever works, period. That's all that matters. Okay, let me copy this because it did not copy over the name right. There you go. Okay. Oh, yeah, I'll make sure these are all in the notes.
Actually, anything? Let me drop that link to my video.
Okay. Was there any other links in here you saw that seemed to talk about? I will say, there is two more links, but they're basically the same thing. I don't want to say the revolution will be televised, but it is, could be a potentially game-changing, revolutionary thing. But I hate to say it. It's going to take 2 or 3 years for this to really make its full impact aware to even end-user consumer-type people. Intel Compute Card. We talked about this a little bit in the past. It's basically a credit card length and width computer, just a little bit thicker. Like I would say 10 credit cards, maybe thick. It isn't crazy thick. They're going to start to ship them in August. What I hate to say is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good it is. It doesn't matter how fast it is. It doesn't matter how affordable it is. It is not the thing. It's everything else that goes around it that's going to make this either popular, marketable, and desirable, or it's not. And what I mean by that is the laptops, the tablets, the TVs,
phone,
the toasters,
your car,
phones. Yeah. Wherever you can shove this in, that's where it's going to be the game changer kind of thing. But I hate to say it, I truly believe it's going to take well over a year for companies like Dell and HP to even acknowledge this thing exists and to start making places where you can shove this.
Mm-hmm.
But it is coming out in August. I do expect there to be a buzz. I do expect people to say how great it is, how fantastic it is. I really hope it ain't crazily priced, but this is the first version of it.
So just think your office computer, your home computer, your laptop, your TV, your refrigerator, and your car can all get the same virus now.
True. But thankfully, unless ransomware is a popular thing on it, then no one will write viruses for it, at least in this day and age. I just love the fact that I can basically have a touch computer in my house and then I can, you know, have batches run on it, tap that, sync this, and then take it out and shove it in the dash of my car and have my interface already configured to what I like and with like available channels and playlists and locations and stuff right there on
it. And so there's a couple of things I love and hate. And when you have the ability of things like Google Maps or Waze on your mobile device, or what I found myself doing is I'll throw in my Google Calendar the location so I can just click on that when I'm in my car and it loads Google Maps and I go there. Or Waze will actually catch that also. So the good and the bad. I have, oh boy, and this so ticks me off. I have the 2015 Genesis Coupe. As far as a sports car, love it. You know, really, really love it. I really like their maps, but because of a couple of things, they're, you know, it's, every X years I can get an upgrade for $100, which kind of sucks. So, but the map does this nice split screen when I'm coming up on a turn and it has a scale that'll tell me like within 2 miles, mile and a half, 500 feet. So I don't have to worry about proportionality and zooming in. So, you know, was it this turn, the next turn? Did I just miss the turn? Because it's really giving me good cues. The other thing I like about the car GPS is when I'm in an underground parking garage or underground highway, it's still sensing off the odometer and the compass, the mag compass, right, as to where I'm going, etc. So great stuff that the car does, but lousy interface for entering information. And if you have the BlueLink subscription, blah, 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 which I, of course, let expire, you can go to a web page and enter it, and then it's on your car.
Gotcha.
So I do like that capability of, you know, having the information go to the car. So if I could plug in, and of course that's the thing that I hate about my car, is all of the lesser versions of my car had the upgrade to Android Auto, whereas my premium blah 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 ultimate edition version of the car did not.
Right. Well, there's Android Auto, and now there's Android Automotive, I believe it's called. Two different things. And the one's brand new this year. The previous one, you had to take your phone, decide, I'm not going to use my phone, I'm not going to touch my phone, I'm not going to look at my phone, plug it up, stick it in the glove compartment, and close it. And then you would have Android on your dash. But it was a very slim down Android interface.
It would read you your text.
Yeah. Only like two clicks deep because of federal law kind of thing. But now they upgraded to where you can have it in your dash mount and have Bluetooth connected. So it's a little bit better. Android Automotive is you don't need to connect your phone to nothing. It's in the car. The board, the processor, the RAM, everything is in the car. That's what's coming next. Volvo and BMW have already said they're going to do it. So in the next couple of years, we'll be able to have this Android-like experience in our car without needing to go without our phone for something.
Mm-hmm.
But with this, if this compute card thing takes off, you know, that might be basically in its place. And this is Intel again versus ARM.
Right.
We don't know which is going to win. But I will say, on once again, shock! I can't believe it. We're going to The Verge again. In the notes, it was link 443. The Verge talks about it. It does say LG is going to have a monitor that you can basically stick the compute card in to turn it into an all-in-one. So my logic is then you have a monitor that you can have connected to a full desktop computer, or you can slap your compute card in so you could have your work computer and your home computer basically separated but use the same monitor, the same keyboard, same mouse. That could actually work. But then their second paragraph, I believe it says, weirdly, I don't know is the right word, but they say, weirdly, Intel's most well-known partners, Lenovo, HP, and Dell, aren't ready to show off their products, Intel says. They'll definitely create something, but we don't have an idea of what those devices might be. So that tells me HP, Lenovo, and Dell said, oh, yeah, don't worry, we're working on something. What are you working on? We can't tell you, but we're working on something, which means we're not working on anything.
We're seeing where the market goes.
Exactly. If this thing takes off, yeah, sure, we'll be there. You'll be able to get the compute card in four versions, starting at the less of it. It is a Celeron N3450 processor, which I believe is the same processor we've talked about on this show at least 50 times. This seems to be the most common small form factor Intel-based computing platform, aka the cheapest that you can get, which is still Intel. Then you have the Pentium N4200 processor.
That's exactly what I have in my upboard.
Right, which is a good processor. They're bad, but it is not, you know, a big time processor. It is just a good processor. The next step up is a 7th generation Intel Core i3 M3 7Y30 processor, which now you're getting to the i3 territory. You'll be able to do a very good amount with that i3 processor, even play some basic games on it with very little issues. Then you go to the 4th. Yes, four versions of this compute card, a 7th generation Intel Core 5 V Pro i5-7Y57 processor. Now, first off, V Pro, we don't think we talked about it on this show, an insanely bad vulnerability in V Pro. People want to talk about WannaCry, SambaCry. They are nothing in vulnerability terms compared to what that V Pro exploit was. That thing was bad. Okay, I don't know how they're going to fix it. I don't know if they can fix it. I don't know, whatever. But if you demand i5 type processing power out of your compute card, well, you'll be able to do it. They all have 4 gigs of RAM. The two higher ones have 128 integrated Intel SSD, and the lower two have a 64 gigabyte eMMC. So I'm going to guess The SSD will have better performance than the MMC. I honestly don't know. They also have different Wi-Fi in it as well. The top 2N just has what looks like a newer version of AC, and the lower two have an older version of AC. This is the old Intel Centrino coming back around, which, to those who don't know, there is no such thing as Intel Centrino. There is no processor called Intel Centrino.
It's a marketing shtick.
It's a marketing stick, which means it's a group of processor, Wi-Fi, and a third thing, GPU, I want to say. That's Centrino. You have the three things that are all aligned, that are all guaranteed to work together in a certain kind of way. But in typical fashion, I don't hear any prices for these compute cards. I'm going to just go out on a limb, and I'm going to say the lowest end Celeron has to be more than $200, because this is Intel we're talking about. You know what I mean? I don't think they see a reason to offer this at any kind of discounted price in the beginning, or at any kind of loss in the beginning, just because they know version one people, the early adopters, are going to buy it no matter what. Right. So I expect the low one could be as high as three something. Up to that fourth one, I don't know. It could go as high as $600 knowing them.
Yeah, see, that's in the no-buy area for me. And just like, so I would compare this to the upboard squared that I got. And I forget what I paid. I think it was $130. For the package that I got.
I know the first upboard was $120 before it was all said and done. I think the upboard squared was around $160, I think.
Maybe it was.
But see, these guys need, dare I say without insulting them, upboard needs to get traction. They need to make a splash. They need to get eyeballs. They need to get market share. Intel, I literally think, is just throwing this out just to see what kind of, you know, traction they can get with it. And with LG immediately on board wanting to make monitors for it, hopefully then we could see combo deals. Buy this monitor and the compute card for, you know, $300, $400. Might work. I don't know.
Yeah, I just looked up my reward. It was a 199 euro. I've forgotten dollars how much that was, but
I know. I can't remember. 199 euro.
Into
USD. Yeah, times everything. $223 right now today.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. Did you have any more links you wanted to bring
up? I'm good. I think we ran long enough already.
Yeah, we definitely had some good stuff too. Brian will be back. Brian had, to me, this is a crazy time of year. You know, holidays, school's getting ready to end. You know, you have all kinds of recitals and I believe it's prom season coming up.
Oh, boy.
Pretty sure. So he will be back. Rich, you have anything you want to end off with?
No, if I haven't said flyingrich.com 100 times, this will be the 100th. So,
right. Or they could just go to the notes.
Go to the notes and look us up at the 3D printing podcast, The Makers.
Yeah, that'd be a lot of fun. I want to thank you, the listener, for downloading. I want to thank you, the listener, for sending us emails. And if you haven't, minipcshow@podnos.com. And if you don't want to type out an email and your voice dictation doesn't work well on your device, you can always give us a call at 707-6-PODNUT, 707-6-PODNUT, and we can get voicemails via normal phone lines that way. With that, we will definitely talk to everyone in about a week.
Hi, this is Matt, the host of the MRP Tech Podcast. I would like to invite you to listen to my show over at podnuts.com. In each episode, I discuss anything tech-related, including Windows, Mac, Linux, iOS, Android, Chrome OS, and so much more. We even get into rocket science. I hope you're enjoying all the great content here on the network, and stay tuned for all the great upcoming episodes by subscribing to our RSS feeds.